Isn't at least a mixture of the winter workshop on Evolution Philosophy, the Rudia and Halde Foundation. This time it is devoted to analyze the problem of the interrelation between science, democracy, and economics. I will not say anything about this problem because all the presentations will be more interesting than anything I can say. I just want to thank, of course, the Rudi Alejandro Foundation for the continued support of the workshop and the other supporting institutions, mainly the Spanish Ministry of Education and Science, the Institute of Philosophy of the Council of Scientific Research, in particular the Science, Technology and Society Unit, and the Spanish Foundation for Science and Technology, and of course this university. And lastly, many thanks to all the people coming, both the speakers, the people that have brought communications, and all the other attendants. And I hope that you enjoy this workshop. Now I pass the turn to Professor Javier Echeverria from the Spanish Foundation for Science and Technology and the Council for Scientific Research, who is going to be the chair of this session. Thanks.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure for me to introduce Professor Steve Farland, who has coordinated with Professor Zamora Bonilla this winter workshop on science, democracy and economics. Congratulations for both, and also for the Urrutia Halde Foundation for the excellent idea of organizing this meeting, which is also supported by the Spanish Foundation for Science and Technology. On behalf of the President of the FECID, the Spanish Foundation, Arturo García Arroyo, welcome to Professor Fowler and to the rest of the invited speakers and communicators. Professor Fowler is undoubtedly one of the most important European thinkers and leaders of the social studies of science and technology. He has published many major contributions in this field. Among his books, I would like to remember only one of the most recent ones, The Governance of Science, which in my view represents a reference work for the study on science and technology. Science is yes. During the last year, he has published also three books more. Thomas Kuhn, Philosophical History of Our Time, Knowledge Management Foundation, and Kuhn versus Popper, The Struggle for the Soul of Science. Thank you very much, Professor Fowler, for the design of this workshop and for your personal presence in Madrid. I am sure that your opening lecture will be a high-level one.
Thank you very much. This is a very generous introduction I've received. I think it should be said that Jesu brought the idea up to me for this conference and really deserves the bulk of the credit for organizing it. I merely suggested a few people who might be invited to speak at it. And I also thank Javier for a very generous introduction in terms of what he regards as my contribution to the field of science and technology studies, which I think is actually quite controversial at this point. Let me address the topic of economic science and democracy, and the title that I've chosen for my talk today is What Do These Three Terms Have to Do with Each Other? Okay? Let me start off with what strikes me as a kind of a natural entry point, but one that might be quite provocative to people who maybe think of themselves as normally thinking about the relationship between economics, science, and democracy. Derek de Solla Price, who some of you may know as one of the founders of scientometrics, right, the science indicators idea, in the late 1960s, de Solla Price was looking for indicators that correlated well with scientific productivity. And the one that he came up with was kilowatt per person expended. Now, this is quite interesting because it's a measure of consumption, not production. Okay? And so what De Sola Price was trying to suggest here, and here is where I think initially our kind of taken for granted notions should be shaken, is the idea that the whole idea that the production of scientific knowledge, the greater production of it, its relation to wealth, generally speaking, doesn't come at the level necessarily of producing more wealth, but rather at the level that you've already got wealth, and so now you can spend it. Okay? And in fact, if you look historically at the kinds of justifications that have been made for the production of scientific knowledge, most of the philosophical ones have been made, you might say, at the consumption end rather than at the production end. So, for example, Aristotle, in the beginning of the Metaphysics, talks about, well, one turns to philosophy, understood in this broad way as the search for knowledge, in a period of leisure. Once one doesn't have to engage in drudgery and providing means for, you know, for one's livelihood and so forth, when one has the time and the space and the resources, one then turns to knowledge. And in fact, since I'm in Spain, I'll mention this point, and I think it's one always worth recalling, is that if you were to go to the early 17th century, when Spain was at the peak of the sort of colonial expansion that was going on during that period, you find there a very large percentage of adult males matriculating at universities, and in fact even getting PhDs, at a level that in fact is only met by Germany and the United States in the early 20th century. Okay? And so from the standpoint of the way in which we normally measure something like the knowledge society today, where we're actually looking at the number of people who go into higher education and get higher degrees and so forth, Spain had already reached this point at the beginning of the 17th century. And in fact, to such an extent that a lot of people who had PhDs, such as Cervantes, weren't able to get the kinds of jobs they thought PhDs could get them, namely colonial administrative jobs, because they were already taken by someone else. So there was a sort of surplus production, indeed very much like we sort of experience today with regard to higher education, where you have too many degrees, right, chasing too few jobs. And of course this led to a sort of golden age in Spanish literature in a way, so there was a kind of upside to this. But the interesting thing about it was that if you look at the history of Spain subsequently, after the early 17th century, you don't see this case of economic dominance and production and so forth as a result of the larger and larger percentage of people going into what we might regard now as the sort of knowledge business. Okay? So there's a sense in which it represented a certain degree of expenditure. It was sort of symbolized a country that had a great amount of wealth, that it could actually enable all these people to go in and get these degrees and spend this amount of time not doing anything productive, but that in itself was not necessarily productive. Okay? And so, and this is a theme that I think goes throughout history. There's a sense in which when one thinks about this business of producing knowledge, producing numbers of books that are of academic relevance and scientific relevance and journal articles and so forth, the track record of this by itself is not necessarily one that is conducive to issues that we associate with economic wealth, and especially economic wealth when we're thinking about the vast majority of people in society. It is rather a consumption measure. And this is one of the things that De Sola Price was trying to bring our attention to in the late 1960s. Now, it's not surprising, therefore, if you take this view seriously, that when today we talk about the relationship between the production of scientific knowledge and wealth creation, we spend our time not actually trying to get into some sort of integral understanding of how science actually helps to transform industry or spread wealth or anything like that, but we look at something like how many patents have been produced. In other words, we move from one bit of paper, academic paper, to kind of the sort of intellectual property paper. And in fact, the relationship between the production of patents and the actual production of wealth that actually benefits people is very uncertain. But nevertheless, when we want to show in a very sort of kind of rough and ready, easy way that in fact, you know, producing more knowledge in universities has some kind of greater wealth benefit, we start pointing to production of patents, and we end the story there. Okay. Now, people who are in the field that I'm normally associated with, the science and technology studies, go in and they do very sort of micro studies, which tend to go in many different directions. But one of the general tendencies that I think one can see is that the best way to get academics to actually increase industrial collective intelligence and so forth is by actually becoming part of the firm. Not by producing papers and then somebody who's associated with industry will then go off and do something with, but rather actually being part of it. Now that's a very important point, because in a sense, that's kind of what the issue is. Namely, and it raises the issue in a very explicit way, namely, do we want academics to be associated with industry in a very direct kind of way, as being part of contributing to what they do, or do we want to keep this kind of distance that has been in the past? And it seems to me that this kind of issue has not really been faced very squarely. So there's a sense in which the issue about what the relationship between the production of scientific knowledge and the production of wealth is one that hasn't really been squarely faced. And at the moment, I think the clearest thing that one can say empirically is that the production of scientific knowledge is primarily a measure of consumption. That is to say, of wealthy nations that can afford to spend money that they don't know where it's going to go. And in a sense, that's a very traditional justification, in fact, for the production of knowledge, especially if you think of leisure as something that people ought to have as human beings, and one of the things that distinguishes us from animals. So the fact that science does waste money is not necessarily considered to be a bad thing. Okay? And I think we need to sort of take that seriously. Now, what the lesson of this is something that I think ought to be discussed very openly. So then let me move the question a little bit further. If for some reason you do think, well, wait a minute, we've got a lot of knowledge around, we've got in fact a lot of knowledge that suggests that we could in fact be increasing the level of wealth in the world, and that doesn't seem to be getting there, then what should our economic attitude be? Right? Now, so the democracy issue gets raised here now through the back door, because in some sense we're saying in advance that we actually care about other people, including people who don't already have either the wealth or the knowledge that other people in the world do, and we're somehow trying to, in a way, mix these two things together in a way that will enable people who are poor to raise themselves. Well, in that case, what should we do? Should we, you know, what's the answer? Well, it seems that the most obvious answer is that production of knowledge isn't really the point to focus on. It's rather distribution of knowledge. And there's a sense in which all of the talk about innovation that goes on now, especially in Europe, much more so than in the United States, and I'd like to offer a hypothesis about this, that the fixation on innovation as being the sort of economic leverage into knowledge is a kind of a sort of second best syndrome, whereby if you're the United States and you're the top dog, you can just restrict trade and you can prohibit things from happening. But if you're not the top dog, then you have to come up with some sort of alternative means to somehow compete. And this is where innovation becomes a very big deal in Europe, in the way in which it is not in the United States with regard to research policy. Okay. So it seems to me that the fixation on innovation is itself kind of a sort of a byproduct of this fixation on production, which I have initially said may be the wrong way to look at this whole issue about the economics of knowledge. And that the issue really lies with distribution. Now distribution... That's okay. The distribution has to do with taking knowledge that's already around, that's already been produced, and making the maximum use of it. Okay, and this is something that I think in a way really hasn't been appreciated as something that ought to be valued as in terms of the economics of knowledge. And you know, those of you who know about university auditing, as we do in the United Kingdom, know that research, that is to say, research that is in the sense pushing forward the frontiers, is always considered much more valuable than teaching or anything that involves distribution of knowledge. And it seems to me that this is a big mistake from the standpoint of trying to address the issues of the relationship between knowledge and economics, where in some sense we're concerned about the democratic result of it. That is to say, the benefit that knowledge can have for most people in terms of raising the standard of living. Now, about 20 years ago, a very interesting study was done by a person, a library scientist at the University of Chicago, called Donald Swanson. It had to do with what he eventually called undiscovered public knowledge. That is to say, stuff that academics had done, which had already been published, but nobody had bothered to read, or had not managed to read in a way, in combination with other things, that enabled people to get the maximum benefit from it. Now, all this talk that I'm going to say about distribution of knowledge, and my defense of the distribution of knowledge, has to do with this kind of issue. One of the things that Price, among others, have pointed out, people who do science indicators, is that there's a sense in which the harder the science, the smaller the percentage of people who actually get cited in the science, and arguably actually get read in the science. So there's a sense in which, even though we are all encouraged to produce as much knowledge as possible that is published in as many international journals as possible, and preferably in English, the fact of the matter is that a diminishingly small percentage of this stuff ever actually gets read and fed back into the production process from which new knowledge is then made. Now, if one is just a manager, not even a knowledge manager, but a manager in the more ordinary sense of the term, this would be regarded as an enormous waste of resources. And it is an enormous waste of resources. And this is where somebody like Donald Swanson comes in and maybe reminds us of something very important here, that there is a lot of value to be derived from the work that has already been published, has already been produced, and that perhaps because it has been slotted into very narrow disciplinary contexts, the maximum value of it has not yet been reaped, has not yet been derived. And so, you know, from the standpoint of practical issues, if I were to sort of want to start a kind of science policy initiative, I would actually give money to people to read things. Because as you know, reading isn't actually counted as a valid activity in science these days from the standpoint of funding. But reading things, I know this is a revolutionary idea, and I know many of you will object to it, right? Because very few people are actually taught to read these days, especially people who are professional academics, who are basically taught to screen, right, and sift through things, and to find what's relevant to things that they're already working on. But I'm talking about reading, right? Getting into what's actually already published there. That there is actually a gold mine of knowledge that has already been produced that has not yet been utilized and could be utilized in much more creative ways, and it wouldn't cost a lot of money to actually pay people to read. And that this could, in fact, enhance the distribution of knowledge. And in fact, it maybe even tilt the balance of knowledge with regard to knowledge production. Because since it doesn't cost very much to read, even people in countries that don't have a lot of upfront capital assets with regard to what we normally think of as knowledge production, you know, so you don't have the big molecular biology labs, you don't have the big particle accelerators, but nevertheless, you might be able to pay people for a sustained period of time to read and then to write up what they come up with. That this kind of matter, which is a very serious matter, it seems to me, could really radically facilitate the flow of knowledge in the world, especially from places that do not feel pressed to have to contribute to what happens to be the latest fad in knowledge production in the let's say top 5 or 10 countries in the world. So it seems to me this is a very important point here. That we talk so much about producing knowledge, From an economic standpoint, producing knowledge is matter is largely a byproduct of consumption. That is to say, you've got money to burn, and so you then, instead of playing, you know, instead of gambling, what you do is you produce knowledge instead. I mean, that's pretty much what the economic story is about knowledge production. Well, now, if we really want to be serious about making knowledge work for economic purposes, we should move on the distribution side. And the distribution side involves reading and actually mining and drawing out from the knowledge that's already there insights that can be combined in novel ways to produce results that might be able to change and help people. Okay. Now, I focus on this because in part, we do have this kind of normatively hierarchical view about the relationship between production and distribution, right? Production is the stuff that the real guys do, and distribution is what those people who apply knowledge do, right? Those guys, they're not quite good enough to get the Nobel Prize like Jeffrey Sachs, and so they go around the world trying to solve the problem of poverty, okay? But there's actually more to the distribution of knowledge than that. There's actually going into the knowledge that's already been produced and drawing out what's already there. Because there's a sense in which, within the knowledge that's already produced, we have produced a kind of new natural resource that has been very much untapped. Right? Especially if one takes the science indicator seriously. And I think this could have a very enormous amount of impact. I mean, this guy Swanson, Javier mentioned all the books I've published. I've actually published another book. And it's the book that actually makes the reference to Swanson and in a way sort of underscores this point that I'm raising here. And the book is called The Intellectual. And this is a book modeled on Machiavelli's The Prince. Okay? And The Intellectual, one of the characterizations that I give of the intellectual, is precisely this kind of person who's engaged in the distribution of knowledge in this sense that I've described, who reads widely across disciplines, who isn't sort of overwhelmed by disciplinary norms and so forth that feel they have to sort of just go with what everybody else is going, but reads widely, looks for things of relevance, and then puts those things forward publicly in a way that they can have some kind of public impact, either in a newspaper or in a policy forum or something like that. And let me tell you, there's a lot of stuff out there that can be recovered in this fashion. And I talk about Swanson's contribution in that context. Because it seems to me that if we really want to talk about the economics of knowledge, we have to look at the stuff that we've already produced that we just haven't used. And unless we're just going to discard this stuff as waste products, you know, we have 50 journals around the world, but 45 of them are worthless, but we don't realize that for 10 years later. I mean, because that does seem to be sometimes the way in which the people in science and metrics and even economics think about this. We have to go back and read and figure out what's there to be recovered and what can be used. And the point is that more than just people from the top producing, knowledge-producing nations can be involved in this. Because all we need is really, you know, you need is access to the journals, and you need the time to read through and to try to sift out the knowledge, okay? And for me, in this new book I've just published, this is the role of the intellectual, who is a person, I use this word, I recover this word, that in many contexts, especially in the English-speaking word, has a kind of negative connotation. I recover this as a way of trying to get at this role that needs to be performed, okay? Now, I should say also, let me just turn from it. Javier, how much time do I have to speak?
24 minutes.
And I can still have some time for discussion? Okay, I'm sorry. I just want to make sure because I do want some time for discussion here. Within the history of economics, not everybody has been very keen on issues of production of knowledge for its own sake, this kind of innovation motivation that we see so much driving things today. To be sure, there's been, of course, a lot of push in that direction. But I want to just briefly mention a couple of people who, in fact, offered some reservations about innovation. And, of course, not surprisingly, these are people who are a bit off of the beaten track from the standpoint of the neoclassical orthodoxy that still dominates today. One of them, of course, is Thorstein Veblen, the institutional economist, the American institutional economist. And there he thought that the drive for innovation was basically an attempt on the part of the wealthy who could invest in these new innovation schemes to basically displace the power that traditional workers had in the crafts that enabled them to do the labor that they were doing. Right? So it was a way of sort of decentering the power base of labor and to centralize the power more on those who could pay for the innovations that could be done. Now, I think that's an important point, and that's not one that should be trivialized by any means. Now, Schumpeter brought up a different issue, a kind of a more macroeconomic issue. In fact, it was the issue that led him to, at the end of the day, despite his having been trained as a so-called Austrian economist, and we all sort of know what that means these days, that nevertheless to endorse socialism. And that was that constant innovation created so many fluctuations in the business cycle, right? As people just start investing in a lot of these, you know, you start to think that value is to be found in the next thing that is going to beat all the market competitors, right? And that's how you start to think about where the notion of value is to be placed, in that kind of future anticipation. That everybody starts investing in all these schemes, right? But only some of those schemes ever actually come to fruition. They actually ever bear fruit. And not only in the sense that not only do some of these schemes ever actually become inventions that work, but only some of these working inventions ever actually get the kind of distribution and consumption patterns that actually warrant the initial investment. And so what this ends up leading, and this is something that Schumpeter was already noticing in the early 20th century, it leads to these very sort of erratic boom and bust cycles. Okay. And that from the standpoint of economic policy, this was just a disaster waiting to happen. And he was already writing about this before the stock market crash in 1929. And it seems to me that there's a very, and this was one of the justifications that he made for having some kind of socialized economy that actually contained the degree to which speculation could take place, the degree to which innovation could be controlling the markets, and so forth, so as to enable people to be able to adjust to changes and also to make sure that there aren't changes that are moving so far ahead that they end up destabilizing the economy as it already is. Okay? So this is an argument from the man who is usually credited, and I think rightly, with having come up with the rather romantic image of the entrepreneur as the sort of standard bearer of innovation, at the end of the day deciding that this is not going to be where the long term lies. It lies rather in the containment of innovation rather than the sort of profligate encouragement of it. Okay? So it seems to me that we have two witnesses here from the history of economics, from Veblen and from Schumpeter, both of them writing at the beginning of the 20th century, telling us that innovation, producing knowledge per se, without concerns about distribution and consumption patterns, is not a good thing in itself, and in fact can lead to economic disasters. And to a large extent, they were right. Okay. Now, in bringing up Schumpeter, I raised now the issue of, how exactly does one contain this business of the economy and the production of knowledge and stuff like this? And I've already indicated, and those of you who know Schumpeter's work know that his last major work, Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy, right, there is an endorsement of socialism in there. And one might say, is the answer socialism? Is socialism the thing that is going to, as it were, manage to reconcile economic science and democracy? And I think to a certain extent the answer is yes. Okay. And there's a sense in which I think socialism has enormous bad press these days, largely because of its precedence in the more totalitarian regions of the world where it's been tried. But I do think, at times like this where socialism is clearly in the decline, clearly seen as sort of a dead dog, it becomes important to sort of go back and retrace and see what exactly was the idea animating this and how did it relate to other ideas. Because I think there is some stuff that we can retrieve there from the standpoint of trying to have some kind of democratic accommodation between science and the economy. And this is where the issue of distribution will come up again. Now here what I want to do in this part is in a way to act very, to speak very much against a tendency that exists within my own field, within science and technology studies, which tends to think of politics very much in market-driven terms. And this is very much characteristic of the sort of neoliberal period in which we live, where there's a sense in which politics boils down to coalition formation, right? Where you basically try to get people together who can agree on something, and there you've got a launch pad for some kind of politics to take place. Okay? This kind of thing was precisely, if we go back to the beginning of the Western political tradition, was precisely the sort of thing that Plato disliked about democracy. And when Aristotle demonized democracy, it was precisely this, namely this ability of coalitions to form in terms of self-interested parties who then find a kind of temporarily common interest, but then dissipate once the interest has been met and then move on somewhere else. And so there's nobody left standing who's actually concerned about the whole, right? The whole society. That is to say, the society of people that includes not only those who can find partners with whom they can form coalitions, but also those who don't have any friends, right? Those who are dispossessed. Now, the interesting thing, of course, is people like Plato, when they were writing, they thought of them, you know, their elite selves as being these kinds of people. And I think that's a very important point about if one understands, let's say, John Stuart Mill's On Liberty as well, why he has a sort of soft spot in his heart about elites, because he doesn't want maturitarian rule either. A lot of it is because a lot of these elite guys realized that if you actually had coalition politics, the people who were very few or who didn't count a lot, and that includes both the very poor and the very rich, wouldn't have any friends. They wouldn't have anyone to form coalitions with. And so one worries about this from both ends, from both the very rich end and the very poor end. Okay? And so even though these kinds of objections to coalition politics, which were very much part of the original ancient objections to democracy, even though these were motivated by people who were very elite, nevertheless I think they do have very much resonance in our time, where one is concerned about the poor, who might not have any friends either. And God knows it's very difficult to get the poor and the dispossessed to have any kind of friends who could form in coalition politics. And I have to say that it's not by accident, it seems to me, that the kind of people who people in my field in science and technology studies typically talk about as being involved in coalition politics, they can kind of raise a kind of democracy and produce a kind of knowledge that's sort of emancipating from the ground up, are typically middle-class people, including middle-class people with AIDS. Okay? And I think this is a very interesting point, of course, because very often the people who do come from these very privileged kind of economic and political backgrounds often have disabilities and illnesses and problems that overlap with people from the poorer countries and so forth. But the reason why they are getting the kind of attention that they're getting in our fields isn't because of its the widespread, large-scale nature of the problem, like AIDS, but rather because you've actually got a group of middle-class, well-educated people in the United States who are able to organize themselves and get involved in the production of scientific knowledge that's relevant for AIDS, and thereby in some way contributing to some kind of cure or whatever, moving the thing forward. And so that looks like a very helpful story, a very positive story of coalition politics actually producing new knowledge. But is this knowledge actually having any kind of knock-on effect in Africa? I don't think so. Okay? I don't think so. And in a sense, the lesson of this kind of coalitional politics as a kind of model for a kind of bottom-up kind of coalition politics of knowledge is very similar, I would submit to you, of the kind of the kind of precedent that was set by the American Revolution in 1776 as a kind of model for revolution around the world. Okay? I mean, we have this, we have a lot of middle class people in the United States who are very much objecting to taxes and so forth. No taxation without representation and all that, which is still, of course, voiced across the United States today. And this was the kind of model for the revolution that took place in the United States. It was the ultimate bourgeois revolution. Now, of course, it resonated over the last couple of centuries with people across the world who were trying to extricate themselves from their economic and political conditions. But make no mistake about it, in order for those revolutions to succeed, they had to take radically different kinds of forms, had to undertake radically different kinds of means. Right? And so in that sense, the only thing that really survived of the American Revolution as a kind of politics for transforming people around the world was just the rhetoric. That survived. But it had to be radically reinstitutionalized, radically changed, and it couldn't just be regarded as this kind of bottom-up effort by people who were sort of interested in promoting their own interests elsewhere. And it seems to me that this kind of awareness, which led to the French Revolution and all the revolutions that took place in Europe in the 19th century, and indeed the revolutions that took place in the 20th century, which had a radically different character from the American Revolution, it seems to me that we need to think about the kind of revolution that could come about from new production of knowledge in this kind of way. That we can't actually look at the kind of grassroots movements that are occurring now, let's say in relation to AIDS, as really the kind of model. Because this is, at the end of the day, a model of middle-class knowledge production that happens to coincide with issues that concern people throughout the world, but don't necessarily spread to those people throughout the world. Okay? So, how much more time?
5 minutes?
Okay. Okay. So, it seems to me what I'm arguing for here is that if we're going to take seriously the relationship between economic science and democracy, we actually have to look at the larger political context in which these things are playing themselves out. And it is not at all clear that if we really take democracy in a very robust sense, that is to say we are concerned about the welfare of each person equally, that the kinds of models that are being promoted now under the ideals of coalition, grassroots kinds of knowledge production and politics are really the way to go on this. And in this respect, I think that the issue of distribution becomes much more important. That there is a sense in which, in the metropoles, as it were, there is already a lot of knowledge that has been produced, that is located already in the academic journals, that is already located in the even universities of the first world that have not been combined and used in a sufficiently imaginative character to be able to have the impact it could have. Because I do think one of the things that one needs to take seriously about the first world, and in particular people who are on the cutting edge of knowledge production as we normally think about it, is these people have actually had a lot of freedom to explore a wide range of things, and we have not yet fully taken advantage of that from the standpoint of providing knowledge that can actually be used to benefit people throughout the world. I mean, in the case of Donald Swanson, who I mentioned earlier from the University of Chicago, the sort of insight that he came up with, and this is a man who originally got his PhD in physics but decided to pursue a career in library and information science, was he actually, some of you may recall, 20 years ago, this did cause a kind of splash in the press. He found a cure for what's called Raynaud's syndrome, which has to do with, it's a problem that a lot of young women have where their fingers become numb. And this was a problem among the female workforce in textile factories and things like this. There was a mystery about how this disease came about, why it was localized to women, what was the source, and all the rest of it. What he basically did was, he was a guy who read very cosmopolitanly, and read across different branches of biomedical science, and basically put together findings from two different fields, published them together, and some scientists decided to test what he was saying as a hypothesis, and turned out he was right. Okay, I mean, that's basically this undiscovered public knowledge. So he himself didn't have a lab, right? He was just a guy who read, was very interested in many different fields, and he just put two things together, you know, in fields that the people who normally work in them would never see across. And then he published them as a hypothesis. and someone tested it, and it turned out to be right. And these were things that had been known for at least 10 or 20 years in the literature, known in that inverted comma sense, right? Because nobody obviously had read it or thought about putting these two things together, but nevertheless was there. Now, the fact that this was in the biomedical sciences, it seems to me, should offer us a lot of hope, because this is the field at the moment we are pumping the most amount of money, right, from the standpoint of, in the sense that we need to produce new knowledge, that there's knowledge not there that needs to be produced that could be used. But in fact, much of the knowledge, even in fields like the biomedical sciences, may in fact already be there, may already be there as a resource, just waiting to be mined. And because we devalue knowledge that isn't new, that isn't hot off the presses, that isn't just produced by yourselves, but somehow involves reading, because we devalue that, we don't actually go out and exploit it and bring it to the surface and enable it to have the kind of benefit that it could have for the larger humanity. Now, you know, if you think about what the ideological implications of this is, first of all, it seems to me you do need some sort of state subsidy or somebody to sort of systematically fund this kind of activity. But second of all, one of the things that I think it does is it brings together two branches or aspects of knowledge that are traditionally kept very separate, namely the humanities, where people just spend their time reading things, and that's considered a perfectly acceptable activity, right? And the applied side of knowledge, right? Where we're in some sense thinking about what the relevance of knowledge is to particular settings and so forth, where we sort of imagine people kind of semi-engineers in some way. But here what I'm suggesting is that these two skills have to go together, and that if we're going to make full use of the knowledge that's already there, if we're really going to be fully engaged in knowledge production, which it seems to me that any kind of democratic approach to knowledge should involve, this kind of knowledge distribution by reading and applying, that this is in fact the kinds of skills that we need to promote and we need to engage in more thoroughly. And with that, I'll close here and open it to questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Steve. We have 20 minutes to dialogue. Are there some questions? Yes.
Maybe you should get the microphone. Well, what I'm presupposing here is, for purposes of this argument, I am presupposing that knowledge is something that, in a sense, can be made public. And I am thinking in terms of books and articles and the written versions as the primary forms of knowledge that, in fact, can be used. That's true. I understand that there are all kinds of other notions of knowledge, and there's tacit knowledge and all the rest of it. If you want to move into that kind of discussion, that's perfectly fine. I think that really does complicate matters, and I do think, I'll say this about tacit knowledge, which I know is very fashionable these days to talk about, is that the long-term tendency with tacit knowledge is for it always to be replaced by something that can be routinized or made public in some kind of way. And it seems to me so that there's a sense in which if we are talking about making knowledge as widely distributed as possible, as readily available as possible, at the end of the day, one of the things that we are talking about is making previously tacit knowledge more explicit, more open, more publicly available. But for purposes of this talk, I'm actually thinking about knowledge in terms of something that has been codified in something like a journal article or a book or maybe a computer program or something of that kind. That is what I'm talking about. I mean, the issue of commodification brings in the issues of what the political economy is within which this publicly formed knowledge is transacted. And I take that to be a somewhat separate question which one can have views about, because I'm not particularly an enamored of commodification. But I think that's a different issue from whether the knowledge is public and available in the first place.
Another one? Yeah. In the talk, you raised the question whether financial publishing wasn't an enormous waste of resource. And then you went on from that to say that we should fund more reading. And I'm wondering whether this opposition between international publishing and reading is a bit overdrawn. What the interview told you, you mentioned this, this guy finding research in a complex going away from two different primary fields and then publishing an article. You mentioned this as an example of the benefit in reading, but I'm wondering, would he have done this if it wasn't to publish the paper in the end? My question really is, isn't the international publishing the basis to promote a lot of reading?
Yeah. I think with all these, you know, with all these kinds of transnational things, there's always a kind of issue of dirty hands here, where in a sense the people who could do the most good are also doing the most harm at the same time. No, I don't want to say we stop international publishing and so forth. In a sense, while I have some views about international publishing and what's going on there, so for example, I do think publishers, you might say, encourage academics' worst vices by seeding new journals in areas that really don't need to have journals in, just because these are potential, as we say in English, cash cows, right, that one can milk for long periods of time. I mean, I think international publishing has a lot to answer for in this regard, the sort of enormous numbers of journals that really don't need to exist, right? Nevertheless, my main argument isn't against international publishers, but it's against, you might say, a policy sensibility that places a greater value on publishing, writing, rather than reading. Okay? And in a sense, I think most academics who consider themselves research active today consider reading an occupational hazard. Namely, you do it because you have to, but if you do too much of it, it can get in the way of what you're really being paid for, which is to write. Okay, and it seems to me that this is really bad news. This is what creates this kind of problem that somebody like Swanson, as you mentioned in your question, was trying to address. I mean, it's interesting, he's in library and information science, which, like a lot of fields that are located in professional schools, are not driven so strongly by the publication imperative, right? They're usually seen as kind of practical or applied fields. And so consequently, they can spend their time reading, right? They can spend their time absorbing things and so forth. And what I'm saying is there should be a greater incentive for regular academics to do this. So one of the practical consequences of my proposal would be that people would, that there wouldn't be an intrinsic value placed on publishing all the time, right? And that there would be some value placed on where you're drawing your stuff from, whether you're making full use of all the material that's there, right? So the fact that you're making use of material that hasn't been used before gets some kind of premium attached to it. You see, so it's in a sense a policy sensibility that I'm really sort of trying to shift here. It's not specifically targeted at international publishers, who I think play a very mixed role in all this.
I think that your argument about the distribution versus collection, I think it's a very interesting argument, and I do really agree with it to a large extent. But I think in this case, I think there's some problems with this, my view. Even though I think, for example, you mentioned the discussion with innovation currently in Polish circles. But I think that precisely that discussion with innovation can also together with a move from production to distribution. In that sense, it's not so much different from what you're arguing here. On the other hand, your reduction of distribution to reading seems to me rather minimalist in the sense of precisely what does it mean to use knowledge? And what does it mean to make knowledge usable for others? To what extent is reading, of course, the thing can be taken here as I have a specific example, but it has a lot to do with who is going to use the knowledge. And of course, it may just increase the intermediary of the kind of knowledge chain. So I think, and of course, this links to issues about passive knowledge, but also links to issues about when you mentioned about when you referred more closely to democracy in terms of who are we talking about when we talk about democracy? Is it the middle class in central countries, or is it the population in Africa? And of course, the reading also comes because it also has to do with who is doing the reading. So just for one more point, I think the sense, for example, your example is John Sanderson. To what extent is he not a kind of a Nobel Prize winner in that specific role? So how does this mean that there may be some kind of a division of those roles in his field of knowledge production, distribution, and consumption? So in a sense, that may be just a kind of a more specific example that more widely reading both previous material does not change the
Okay, you're raising some very valid points here, and maybe I should make some points explicit here. And in a way, this kind of makes the whole proposal controversial, more so than it already is. One of them has to do with exactly what reading does in all this. Because I guess I suppose if one thinks of the sort of humanistic model of reading, and in fact this is one of the reasons why especially natural scientists and even social scientists don't like the humanities very much, is because reading seems to be a kind of self-perpetuating kind of thing, right? Where you just create more intermediaries and commentators, and in a sense you never really figure out what's going on. Instead, you just have a lot of people's careers floating on other people's footnotes. It seems to me but what Swanson was doing here wasn't that, right? So there's a sense in which the way in which Swanson put the two different bodies of knowledge together wasn't just in terms of two footnotes, but rather actually it performed something that the two individual bits of knowledge didn't have by themselves. Okay, so it wasn't merely an attempt to sort of bolster authority and show alliance to other people, the way in which reading often seems to manifest itself in writing in the humanities, but rather it was actually to come up with a kind of new knowledge, you might call it an innovation if you will, that is drawn from two bodies of knowledge where it didn't exist in that form. Right? So in a sense it's like a sort of dialectical synthesis where once he's actually come up with what turns out to be a cure for Raynaud's syndrome, the fact that it came from these two different bodies of knowledge doesn't matter anymore. Right? It's no longer providing authority because the thing kind of works on its own terms. So it isn't necessarily, this kind of reading that I'm talking about, the form of knowledge that it ends up producing, isn't necessarily one that just proliferates intermediaries and commentators and all the rest of it, but actually manages to make some kind of qualitative breakthrough that wasn't there before. So I think that point about it, so in that sense, yes, it's not totally anti-innovation, in the sense it's providing another means by which innovation can occur. In a sense, what I'm reacting to, you might say, is the contemporary rhetoric of innovation, which in a sense is very anti-reading and very anti-past in many ways. The other point is about Swanson. You say, Swanson maybe ought to be getting a Nobel Prize for this kind of thing. The interesting thing about Swanson, and this is only something that I found out recently, was that his work, which dates from the mid-1980s, has actually been provided some of the impetus for what in the corporate sector of knowledge management is known as data mining, if you've run across that expression, data mining, right? Whereby you go and you look at databases and you try to find new patterns, new things that maybe people who had put them there hadn't seen before. And so corporations, right, rather than just investing a lot of money in R&D labs, right, where in a sense what the corporations would end up doing is just reproducing stuff that's already happening in universities, what they do is instead they get people who can sort of read through databases, look at books, things like this, to see patterns that may in fact lead to some sort of profitable, you know, outcomes, you know, patents or new products or inventions and things like this. And Swanson's work, which was done in a purely academic context, right, has provided a lot of the motivation for this. But interestingly, this initiative, I mean, I'm sure none of you, or very few of you, have ever heard of Swanson's initiative, right? But this has, in fact, been picked up in the corporate world. But it hasn't been picked up in the academic world, or what we normally consider, you know, to be sort of the heartland of basic research. And that, I think, is very striking, right? And in a sense, this is what I'm advocating, because otherwise, the corporate sector has already been picking up on this. In fact, this is one of the reasons why, you know, I thought that the field of knowledge management was a very important field to get a kind of normative grip on, because it's moving in to a large extent into a lot of these areas.
We have time for two questions.
Yeah,
don't we already live like that? No.
Yeah. Just not the same 15 minutes.
Oh, no.
Right, right, exactly. That's your point.
Right.
Yeah.
On the average, I'm not sure. So slowing down more, it will get me on the average.
No, that's interesting. It's a very interesting point. Let me start with the general point about the slowing down. Dispositionally, myself, I hate to think of myself as someone who advocates slowing down things, because I'm not a very slow person in any sense. But nevertheless, it does seem to me a lot depends on how we, this is where sociology, sociology, even though it's a field that has had very mixed career, one of the values of the field is that it forces us to think about who is society, what is part of society. And there's a sense in which if we have in our sights, let's say humanity as a whole, right, there is a sense in which we are forced to be concerned with the fact that there are people who seem to be way behind us. Right, especially they are people who in some sense, by our own lights and our own theory, should in principle be where we are, because they have the capacities to do so and so forth, but they're just not allowed to do it. So we've got a real issue of trying to bridge the gap there. And you know, one can say whether this has to end up being egalitarian at the end of the day, okay, that's a different question, but we have a problem with gap here, okay? And I guess part of part of the way I'm thinking about this, and the reason why I bring up this issue about looking at the knowledge that's already been produced and going into that, is because I think there's a sense in which one of the things that we expect of human beings, including human beings who are way far behind us, is that they're able to produce something that everybody regards as meaningful. Not just their own subsistence like animals, but produce something that's publicly more recognizable. And so in a sense, part of the concern, you know, part of the interest that I have in the fact that one could look at knowledge that's already produced without having to spend a lot of money comes from that, right? In the sense that one could be a relatively poor country, but as long as one has access to the libraries and the facilities, one could put together knowledge in new ways and come up with things that would be innovative. You know, it would be kind of a low-tech demonstration of innovation that would even impress people outside of those immediate regions. And because there's a sense in which there are many gaps that have to be narrowed here, and it's not just a matter of narrowing the amount of attention people have or narrowing even the amount of money people have, but also the respect, right, which comes from people recognizing that one is doing something worthwhile. And I think one of the problems from the standpoint of knowledge production is that the only things we really value is the big stuff, right? And if you want to, you know, explain the brain drains that happen around the world and why people think they're not doing anything important unless they're living in the United States, right, it comes from that. And it seems to me that that issue really does need to be very substantially addressed. And I do think that there are means at our disposal which has to do with taking advantage of the knowledge that's already available. And this is something that one doesn't have to be terribly rich to do, and I think could shake up things. You know, now how this ends up relating to the speed issue, you know, it depends what your metric is, because there's a sense in which we're wasting a lot of the knowledge we produce at the moment, and that's not normally regarded as a terribly great value. And so here we're talking about actually making better use and more use of the knowledge that's already there. So there are different sorts of values one might be trading off against. Speed isn't everything, you see, and taking more time, we actually might be able to make better use of what's already there. So I mean, you're raising a very complicated kind of issue here, but I do think insofar as we think of all of humanity as potentially encompassed in society, then we do have a responsibility for thinking about exactly how do we imagine in the long term, if we have knowledge being produced in the way it is at the moment, where a smaller and smaller fraction of all the knowledge producers are getting most of the attention, having an increasingly decisive impact on the rest of what's happening. How do we ever expect to redress the gaps that exist? See, I just don't know how that's going to happen from a knowledge standpoint. I mean, from an economic standpoint, of course, that's a big problem too, but at least people recognize that. And you got Jeffrey Sachs going around the world talking about it. But we don't really have people addressing it at the knowledge level, it seems to me. In fact, we have people thinking about it as some kind of invisible hand, right? That all the best knowledge is produced in the best places by the best people. If you're any good, you'll end up there. It seems to me that's a real big mistake, and that's really the kind of issue that I'm trying to address there. I know that doesn't really answer your question, but I'm just trying to give you a sense of background sensibility that I'm coming from in saying this. Okay. This way we ensure that he actually reads a lot of Well, I mean, there's a lot of issues here. First, let me start with with what I guess turned out to be a slip of the tongue, which I thought was actually going to be the main force of your remark, which was the business you said, education rather than reading, if you recall, beginning. I think, you know, when we talk about what is the aspect of knowledge that actually does encourage the welfare and wealth of people generally, it's the education side, and it's not the education side with regard to PhDs. You recall the little example I gave about Spain in the early 17th century. Well, one could give a similar story about Egypt and places like this, where there's a lot of people who are trained in very elite levels of education, but not necessarily trained at the primary and secondary school level. So there's a sense in which, in terms of the distribution of knowledge, the other side of the story that really needs to be focused on is subsidy for education, even at the expense, perhaps, of higher funding for university research. Okay, that's one point. And I didn't talk about that in this talk, but it seems to me that that is also part of the equation as well. That there is a sense in which we end up overvalorizing university as a site where all knowledge is going to lead to welfare and wealth and so forth. But in terms of what you're saying about peer review, it seems the problem with peer review is that you don't have enough of the peers participating in it. If we imagine all the people who actually consider themselves members of a given disciplinary community, both as readers and researchers, a very, very small percentage are in fact involved in so-called peer review, and not surprisingly, those people tend to reproduce their image of what the fields are. So in a sense, peer review, you know, is, as it were, the main means by which you get the kinds of problems I'm talking about, right? So in that respect, peer review is a misnomer, right? I mean, it's kind of really not telling you what's going on. So the issue here, peer review isn't really going to solve the issue unless one really opens up the range of peers who are participating. And if you were to do that, okay, then I think you get some very interesting, startling results, especially if you ask peers to comment on the relevance of what people are publishing. And those of you, I mean, I peer review for like over 30 journals in many fields, and it's interesting how rarely you get asked explicitly to ask about the relevance, except with regard to very narrow issues in the discipline. So peer review is not going to be the answer to this problem that I'm talking about here. Okay, now, the business about, I mean, I think one thing that we do is we valorize publishing too much. In that respect, I do agree with you. I don't necessarily think the answer is less publishing, but I do think the answer is encouraging people to, as it were, publicize whatever knowledge they have by whatever outlets are available. And here I would just say there was a very interesting study done in the United States now about 15 years ago, by the Carnegie Foundation on teaching called Scholarship Reconsidered, which was basically looking at, I mean, those of you who know about the American education, higher education system will know that it's very diversified, right? You've got, as it were, a university for everyone, right? From complete idiots to the Ivy League. And you've got everything, and you've got it, so it's a complete, you know, you want to say, you know, this is, you know, exemplary of the market, what the market can do for you, right? Give you all these niches, okay? Well, so what they did was they asked people in all of these various niches, and the Carnegie Foundation has identified 8 or 9 or 10 of these niches, different types of higher education markets, what they consider scholarship. And it was only the people at the very top end, at the sort of Ivy League doctoral granting institution end, that really valued this business of publishing and peer-reviewed publications in the sort of main disciplinary journals. But the rest of these people thought that their scholarship was best expressed, you know, through teaching. So they go to conferences, they're not giving papers necessarily, they're in the audience, they're soaking it up, and then they're translating it into their teaching. So their syllabus might get updated, right? They're teaching the kids the new stuff, right? And there are all these different ways in which the new knowledge gets distributed, not just through publishing more articles of the same, but through these other media. And this was one of the things that came out, and it was basically, the foundation's argument was, look, we shouldn't try to have every institution of higher education imitating the Ivy League. We should allow them to go to the various different media that are best suited for the ways in which they normally distribute knowledge. And we should actually reward people for doing that and encourage people to do that. And sure, there will always be some people who will publish a lot of papers. But that's not the only way by which knowledge gets produced and reproduced, and it shouldn't be the only way in which it gets rewarded. Right? And that's the issue, is the rewarding. Because look, if I go publishing 500 papers and you don't read them, it doesn't really matter very much, except if I end up becoming the most important person in the world. Right? Then it starts to bother you. Right? But as long as, you know, there's some proportion to these matters, then it doesn't matter how much people read. It's rather whether people are being rewarded for what they're doing with regard to distributing knowledge. And people can, as it were, move toward their strength and be rewarded for moving toward their strength. And this was what the Carnegie Foundation was arguing back in 1990 with regard to American universities. And this is kind of the, you know, the more sort of diversified notion of distribution that I'm talking about here.
Thank you very much, Steve, for your very interesting thoughts and answers. We have, I hope that we have a new opportunity to